Barrett wrapping up that short set of music as we are approaching the top of the hour with Octopus. Before the Syd Barrett, the Toadies went back to an album they put out called Heretics, where they re-envisioned a lot of their songs. So I played their big hit from the 90s, Possum Dixon. Possum Dixon, that's another band. Possum Kingdom, the name of the song I played for you. Hey, you know what? I do need to remind you of one thing and one thing only. That's each and every Thursday. You can join your rockin' attorney, Eric Jackson Lurie, for Courts in Session. It's 2.5 hours of rock and roll, country, and soul with a focus on new music by your favorite classic artist. Again, it's Thursdays at 8, and it re-airs on Monday afternoon. Monday afternoon. You are listening to the Viva La Mock radio program, and my name is Paul, and I appreciate you listening. As always, you're thinking, hey, there's a song I want to hear on a future show. Well, you know what you have to do. There's only one thing you have to do. You have to email me. So if you email me, I might play it. Yeah, so the email address is wrctrequest@gmail.com. Indeed, that is the email address.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, dropped by her law firm, resigning from her law firm after being exposed as an advisor on the post-2020 election call, where Donald Trump told Georgia officials to find him some votes, Cleta Mitchell has leaned in on the brand of election integrity. Platformed on right-wing talk radio, she's now saying that Democrats are, quote, literally getting people to lie, close quote, to exploit laws that allow overseas citizens to vote. So she's bringing lawsuits. Does she have evidence? No. Is evidence the point? Also no. We spoke with media law attorney and reporter Sean Musgrave, who serves as counsel to The Intercept, about how Trump's big lie attorneys are not so much returning to the field, but actually never left. Also on the show, in 2018, elite media had apparently moved beyond the knee-jerk reportorial pairing of documentation of voter suppression with hypothetical claims of voter fraud, but they were still doing faux naive reporting of those fraud claims as something other than themselves a deliberate suppression campaign. Then the shiny object was then Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach trying to change registration laws in the state. We talked with Orion Danjuma, staff attorney with the ACLU's Racial Justice Program. That's coming up on Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. When you hear that Rudy Giuliani has been ordered to turn over valuable possessions, including a Manhattan penthouse, watches, and a signed Joe DiMaggio jersey, to the two Georgia election workers he falsely accused of ballot tampering in the 2020 election, you might believe that, though the harm is ongoing, at least the lawyers who propped up Donald Trump's efforts to delegitimize the 2020 vote have paid some kind of price. And indeed, cat's paws like Sidney Powell, like John Eastman, have faced repercussions. But our guest explains, not only is the scaffolding of Trump's voter fraud hoax still standing, some key architects are still hard at work on it. Sean Musgrave is a media law attorney and reporter who serves as counsel to The Intercept, where you can find his recent piece, Trump's Big Lie Attorneys Are Back. He joins us now by phone from here in town. Welcome to Counterspin, Sean Musgrave.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, the key elements of the piece are right there in the lead. Across battleground states, attorneys who helped former President Donald Trump undermine confidence in the 2020 election results are back at it, filing lawsuits that seed doubt in advance of this year's outcome. Let's start with the lawsuits themselves as lawsuits. What are the claims being made, and what can we say about those claims?
So the lawsuits that I looked at fall into a couple of different buckets. One, alleging the possibility of voter fraud for overseas ballots under a federal law that helps U.S. citizens abroad, including members of the military and their families, to vote. And in several states now, Republicans have filed last-minute lawsuits with voting already going on, including overseas ballots, claiming that there's a possibility of fraud using this mechanism. And then the second bucket of lawsuits that I look at in this piece is another go-to boogeyman, which is the cybersecurity of voting machines. And the case that I look at is filed in Georgia over Dominion voting machines, which, again, were just one of the centerpieces of the election fights in court in 2020, and it looks like they will be again this year.
Well, you note that these are last-minute lawsuits being put in there, but still, in terms of evidence, in terms of information, what can we say about, for example, fraud in overseas voting?
So many of these lawsuits have already been rejected. They've been thrown out by courts, including the basis that the people filing them did not show any evidence of actual fraud that had been happening. It's all based on hypotheticals in the lawsuits themselves.
And the Dominion case, that's not new news for folks. That's also been kind of churned through, hasn't it?
The Dominion claims are very much recycled from 2020 and from other cases that were filed in between the 2020 cycle and now. And it just really underscores the fact that these are also many of the same attorneys who are trying to just recycle the legal playbook.
The big, big lie attorney that you're writing about in this piece is Cleta Mitchell. And so what should listeners know about her and what she's up to?
Cleta Mitchell is very central to the election denial movement. And in 2020, she really came to prominence by being on the infamous call that Trump had with the Georgia Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, in which Trump asked the Georgia Secretary to find a few thousand votes. Gladda Mitchell was advising Trump on that call, and she resigned from the law firm that she was at the time, and then has really since made election integrity, so to speak, her entire brand. And now, in terms of her involvement this cycle, she has given this pretty frank interview, not to me, but to a conservative radio host, describing her involvement in putting together and helping organize the lawsuit overseas ballots. And she said she struggled to find an attorney who was willing to file one that was ultimately filed in Pennsylvania.
Well, I guess there's something heartening about that, actually, about the difficulty of finding attorneys who would line up behind what looks clearly to be a specious set of lawsuits. And just as a detour, there is something about the abandonment of principle, you know, the politicizing of the professions. Doctors who can say, well, torture is okay, you know, and lawyers who can abandon ethical codes. It's somehow different than just being a bad lawyer, you know. It really feels like a really giving over of the whole principles of the profession. So I guess I'm happy to hear that it's not so easy to turn up attorneys who will sign on to that.
That was in Pennsylvania, where Claudia Mitchell said she had a hard time finding anyone else to file it. In two other states where the Republican National Committee were the ones filing, other attorneys were found.
Right. Well, then to bring us back, there's no evidence, as you've indicated, for these charges. They haven't been able to put forward any evidence, and they weren't in the previous incarnations of these. So maybe it's time to recognize that evidence and even winning the lawsuit is not the point. What is the point, do you think, of these last-minute lawsuits?
When I talk to election law experts, they certainly don't think that the point of most of these suits is to win in court, to convince a judge that they have evidence to support the pretty drastic request that they're asking a judge to give. In the overseas ballots cases, asking for a court order that state election officials set aside ballots that were received from people who went through the registration process as it was when their ballot was sent. But that doesn't seem to be the point to convince a judge that they should win on this. It really does seem to be to essentially put out a press release put together to look like a lawsuit to sprinkle a little doubt into the public's thinking about the election headed into November.
And so then maybe if the Trump team, whatever happens, we don't know, but if the Trump team decides to dispute the election results, well, then those seeds of doubt have already been laid, and people will say, oh, I remember something from even before the election about overseas ballots being perhaps corrupt, right? So it can be successful in its real goal, even if nothing at all happens in court or if it gets thrown out.
Yeah, and I should mention in the same radio interview, Claudia Mitchell implied that she already had evidence, but none of it made it into the lawsuit. She told the conservative radio host that Democrats were encouraging people to fraudulently register using these overseas mechanisms. So the striking is what is said out of court versus what actually goes into the lawsuit itself. And I think, again, looking at what happened in 2020, same dynamic is that people will point to the lawsuits, even though the lawsuits don't have any actual proof of fraud, and kind of use the filing of the lawsuit itself as its own form of proof, even though the lawsuit itself doesn't contain proof.
Well, it's very Joe McCarthy. I have a list right here in my hand, you know, and it turns out to be a blank piece of paper. It doesn't matter. People see him holding what he says is a list, and the impression is made. Well, I don't want to say that we don't see any reporting that is acknowledging folks like Claudia Mitchell's strategy, as an intention of sowing doubt. The New York Times just on October 22nd had a piece on the Election Denial Network. But I know that listeners will also have seen coverage that just says concerns raised about overseas voting, and stories that if you don't read them carefully, or even if you do read them, the very fact that the story got written suggests that there's a there, that there's a valid question, even if, oh, well, we looked into it and actually it's not grounded. There's no evidence there. And I wonder, what do you as a reporter, as well as an attorney, see as the professional, critical way for journalists to engage this sort of campaign that uses legal tools and legal language and legal mechanisms, but isn't really about the legality. How do you cover that?
I do think that it's important for reporters to be clear-eyed about what the strategy is, which is to get coverage of the lawsuit just as a lawsuit and put it into this neutral reportage territory. Like you said, concerns raised. My typical one that drives me nuts is lawsuit filed or something like that, that really just says what the claim was without looking, as I am currently doing, at consider the source, consider the lawyer who is willing to sign their name to this and think about what that means. The Times today actually had a good story about one of the attorneys that I've also written about, Kurt Olson, and his background. And he was deeply involved in 2020 in a number of different efforts, including trying to get the election fight straight to the Supreme Court on a pretty ridiculous theory that was panned by legal experts. But I just remember coverage at the time really focusing just on the stakes of the Supreme Court weighing in and kind of painting it as if it were similar to what happened in Bush v. Gore, things like that, as opposed to the extraordinary way that the lawsuit arrived at the Supreme Court in 2020. That's sort of what I'm trying, not to be too grandiose, but to do a little bit of corrective on. It's just focus on the people that are involved and the attorneys who are willing to put their law licenses on the line and sign their name and attest that everything in the papers is true, even when they have often a kind of checkered track record on that front.
Well, and not to draw you out on it too much, but it isn't that reporters can't consider the source, because in some other cases they say, oh, well, this is the ACLU, or, oh, this is this other organization, so maybe we ought to put an asterisk next to that. But isn't that they can't do that? It just seems that they don't do that in the way that would always be most balanced or most useful when it comes to electoral politics, or something somehow changes when it gets to presidential electoral politics. But let me just ask you for final thoughts, Sean Musgrave, about the way, because it's not going to go away. We have indicated that these lawsuits are coming in at the last minute while folks are already voting. So clearly it's a last minute press in many ways that we might see even more coverage of going forward. What should we be keeping an eye out for? What would you like to see more of or less of as reporters cover this going forward?
What I aim for, and what I think that other reporters should aim for too, is to take a moment on some of these stories, as so many of these lawsuits are kind of flying, and look at trends, look at not just the parties who are named in the lawsuit itself, like the RNC, the DNC, ACLU, different voting rights groups, which are often very generically named, and try to look at the people who are actually working on them. Because I do think, seeing from the postmortem on 2020, the people really mattered in terms of what strategies were followed, which lawyers Trump was listening to, which he was sidelining and ignoring or forcing to resign. Like, we know from 2020, the people who were actually working on particular lawsuits matter incredibly. And I think going into the election and afterward, when there are absolutely going to be lawsuits of one kind or another, it's important that readers understand who the people are, not just faceless attorneys, because it mattered in 2020, and I assume it'll matter again.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. We've been speaking with media law attorney and reporter Sean Musgrave. You can find the work we're talking about at theintercept.com. Thank you so much, Sean Musgrave, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me.
Things were different 6 years ago, but not all that different, when Counterspin was talking about the federal trial in which Kansas Secretary of State Kris Kobach, fresh off claiming that Trump won the popular vote, quote, if you deduct the millions of people who voted illegally, close quote, was defending the law he drafted requiring prospective voters to show their papers, i.e. citizenship documents. In March of 2018, Counterspin asked Orion Danjuma, staff attorney at the ACLU's Racial Justice Program, to explain the law at issue in the case.
The law was passed initially in 2011 and began to be implemented in 2013 after extensive delays that the state gave to Mr. Kobach to start putting this law into place. And the law was passed under the pretense that there was this wave of this threat of hordes of non-citizens who were potentially infiltrating voting booths and voting in elections and changing the result of American elections. And the law was basically passed on these anecdotal reports that people saw someone who looked like a Muslim lady or African immigrants at polls and were protesting the fact that those individuals might not be citizens. After the law was passed, the state saw almost immediately tens of thousands of individuals whose voter registration applications were suspended and blocked from registering because they couldn't come up with the documents the state was demanding, a birth certificate or a passport. And part of that was the fact that the law was so poorly implemented and so confusingly explained or not explained to individuals that even some people who had documents were denied an opportunity to register to vote. And then many others who were simply too poor to have the necessary documents or couldn't locate them were unable to provide those documents by the time they needed to register to vote. And basically what we saw as the ACLU brought suit, because approximately 14% of new voter registration applications, over 30,000 individuals between January 2013 and December 2015 were blocked by this requirement. That restriction violates federal law, the National Voter Registration Act, which requires that states make voter registration simple and straightforward. So we brought suit to block this restrictive registration requirement.
And it was, in fact, blocked. And is this now part of trying to decide whether that law is going to stand at all?
What happened is that in 2016, in advance of the 2016 election, we brought suit and requested a preliminary injunction. And the judge who was assigned to the case issued a preliminary ruling in 2016 saying that it certainly looked very likely that this law violates federal law, which is supposed to make it easy to register to vote, but delayed a decision on the final merits until a full trial could be had after the election. And that judge's decision was upheld by the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, and no appeal was taken to the Supreme Court at that time. So that preliminary injunction has blocked the law since 2016. Basically, the judge then said to Secretary Kobach, you now have an opportunity to prove whether or not non-citizen voter registration fraud is actually a problem. That court and the Court of Appeals said that from the evidence produced thus far, it seemed that the idea that non-citizens were registering to vote was so minimal as to be negligible. The court essentially said it is a nominal problem at best, and the Court of Appeals said that the secretary's claims that lots of non-citizens registering to vote was simply pure speculation. So what's at issue right now in this trial that's taking place in Kansas City is it's really Secretary Kobach's put up or shut up moment. For literally years at this point, he's been using this threat of non-citizens voting in elections as a pretext for restrictive voter registration requirements. And he's only had to sort of defend these wild allegations on Fox News or various sort of very sympathetic forums. And what's different now is he has to come into court to really come up with actual evidence. And I can say that at least from our perspective as the plaintiffs, his showing has been completely disastrous. All of the evidence that he's sought to introduce at trial has been riddled with errors, has been statistically incomprehensible, or simply outright fabrications and lies. Ultimately, it's going to be up to the court to decide whether the evidence that he's provided is significant or not. But that is the meaning of this trial, is it's essentially, it is a test of the claims that he's now made for years about whether non-citizens really are voting in elections or not.
Well, this whole line, and I think corporate media are still credulous about it to a certain extent, is that there is some valid concern about voter fraud, that experts might disagree about the numbers, but you're still given to understand that there's some there, you know, that it's a dispute anyway, you know, and even if an article winds up concluding, as the courts have, that voter fraud is not a significant problem, still the article posits it as the object of concern, you know, and documents, including testimony from Kobach that the ACLU obtained, really illustrate the extent to which it is a purposive red herring. And I wonder if you could just talk a little about the what you have called the plays in Kobach's voter suppression playbook.
Absolutely. So over the course of this litigation, shortly after the judge in this case entered a preliminary injunction blocking the law after we filed suit, as I mentioned, that decision was issued a few months before the 2016 election. Right in the wake of that election, the Secretary of State was photographed going into a meeting with Donald Trump, and in his hand was a document, a sort of memo, Secretary Kobach's master plan for the Trump administration. And one key item on it was to draft amendments to the National Voter Ruh, and the rest of that document was covered up by his arm. So in the course of that, of the litigation in advance of trial, we were able to obtain access to those documents. The Secretary's office fought us literally tooth and nail. I can tell you that there are probably 60 docket entries. I've never filed as many papers over a mere document dispute as I did in this case. But the reason why it was so critical is that the Secretary's own evidence showed that his claims were completely false and invalid. What we found is that not only was there this agenda that Mr. Kobach had brought into a meeting with Mr. Trump, Mr. Kobach had actually prepared a version of a draft amendment which would allow him to impose a birth certificate or passport requirement on voters, even if there were no proof at all that any non-citizens were registering to vote. And I think it's really clear, and then he was aggressively lobbying immediately after the 2016 presidential election to try to get Mr. Trump and his senior advisors to pass new legislation to make it harder to vote. And why I think that's so critical is that for years, the Secretary has been saying that non-citizens are registering to vote. They're everywhere registering to vote. But as soon as he's forced to go into court to prove that that's happening, he desperately tried to change the law to eliminate the requirement that he come up with any proof at all. And I think that's really, really clear evidence that he just knows he doesn't have any proof. He knows that this is really just about blocking individuals who he doesn't want to vote from getting to the polls easily. And that is one of the reasons why laws like these are so dangerous and why a trial like this that gets to the bottom of what the evidence really is so important.
And it's why I would hope that media would change their angle of approach to the story. You know, they're no longer balancing rhetorically voter fraud and voter suppression, you know, in the same way that they used to. But I still feel that they fall short of describing an actual thought-out plan to suppress the votes of the young and the poor and people of color, you know, and covering it and approaching it in that way. It still makes it sound as though some people think this, some people think something else, and we have to kind of hash it out, you know. So what I want to say is you show that Kobach has had these plans for a while now, you know, from before the election. And I've just read that if he loses this case in Kansas, he still has his friend Steve King in Congress who is set to try to push through this we don't need evidence rule at a national level, that he could try to win in a different way if he loses in Kansas City?
Shortly after the election, in the early part of 2017, President Trump sort of made a surprise announcement that Secretary Kobach was going to be appointed as the de facto head of the Voter Integrity and Election Commission. And that was a huge alarm bell for all of the voting rights community, because we knew that the only reason he would be in a position like that was to create a sort of false narrative about the scope of voter registration fraud to basically lay the foundation for an amendment to federal voting rights law to make it much harder to vote. Now, after sort of the extreme incompetence that Secretary Kobach displayed, that commission basically hiding documents from members of the commission itself, not abiding by any of the requirements for any presidential commission, he basically failed to do the bare minimum of what you need to do in an investigatory commission appointed by the President of the United States. Now the commission has been disbanded because it was so poorly run. But you're absolutely right. Either at the federal level through federal legislation or at the state level by enacting restrictive voter registration regimes or new voter ID requirements, there is a core of individuals who is dedicated to suppressing the right to vote, not based on any legitimate fear of fraud, either by non-citizens or individuals voting in multiple states, but simply because they don't want certain voters to participate in the political process. And that is a fundamental threat to our most important civil right and civil liberty. For Secretary Kobach, I think he felt there was a way to lock in a voter pool that he liked, the current set of registered voters, and erect a wall to make it as hard as possible for new, young voters, unaffiliated voters, to join the political process and get involved.
That was the ACLU's Orion Danjuma speaking with Counterspin in March of 2018. And that's Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on our website, fair.org. That's also the place to show much-needed support for Counterspin if you are able and so inclined. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, climate disruption is outpacing many scientists' understanding of it, and it's undeniably driving many harms we are facing. Extreme heat, extreme cold, devastating hurricanes and tornadoes. News media are giving up pretending that these extreme weather events are just weird and not provably driven by the continued use of fossil fuels. But fossil fuel companies are among the most powerful players in terms of telling lawmakers how to make the laws they want to see. Public interest be damned. So the crickets you're hearing about efforts to eviscerate the right to protest the impacts of climate disruption, well, that's all intentional. We'll hear about what you are very definitely not supposed to hear about from reporter Emily Sanders from Exxon News. Also, and related, not everyone is lying down and accepting that, okay, we're going to die from a climate crisis that is avoidable. But since companies don't want to talk about it, let's not talk about it. A county in Oregon is saying deaths from high heat are in fact directly connected to conscious corporate decision-making, and we're going to address it that way. We'll hear about that potentially emblematic story from Victoria St. Martin, longtime journalist and journalism educator, reporting on health and environmental justice at Inside Climate News. Employing the law to silence dissent on life or death concerns, or using the law to engage those concerns head on. That's coming up today on Counterspin. We'll get right to it. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. We have not forgotten the years of protest by the people of Standing Rock in resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline. The cause could not have been more fundamental. The news and images were dramatic, and the support was global and cross-community. Fossil fuel makers, who would like to keep making money from the destruction of the planet's capacity for life, along with their ally enablers in law and law enforcement, want nothing like that to ever happen again, and certainly not for you to see it and take inspiration. Pursuant to that, our new efforts reported by our guest. Emily Sanders is senior reporter for Exxon News, a project of the Center for Climate Integrity. This story was co-published with The Lever. She joins us now by phone from Queens. Welcome back to Counterspin, Emily Sanders.
Hi, thanks so much for having me again.
Well, we're talking to start about congressional actions. What is the context behind this new rulemaking authorization process that you're writing about? And how did laws around pipeline protest get into this conversation?
Congress is currently working to reauthorize the Pipeline Hazardous Materials and Safety Administration, or PHMSA, which would set the agency's funding and mandates for safety rulemaking on pipelines over the next few years. And that's at the same time as the agency sets out to make new rules for carbon dioxide pipelines. And both these processes are especially crucial right now as the oil and gas industry plans to build out tens of thousands of additional miles of pipeline for carbon capture projects. And CO2 is an asphyxiant. It can travel long distances. It can shut down vehicles and sicken, suffocate, or even kill people and wildlife. So these pipelines can be incredibly dangerous if and when they leak, as was the case in Satartia, Mississippi in 2020, when a Denbury pipeline, now owned by ExxonMobil, ruptured and stalled emergency vehicles, sent nearly 50 people to the hospital with reportedly zombie-like symptoms. So after that, and now in the wake of yet another leak in Sulphur, Louisiana earlier this year, advocates and community members have really been pushing the agency to take a hard look at these pipelines and provide more transparent information to communities and first responders who are often just underfunded or volunteer fire departments tasked with dealing with these leaks at the last minute. And they're asking the agency to implement real rules and oversight for the companies that, in these cases of leaks, were not appropriately monitoring their sites. So back in April, I reported on how the oil industry was lobbying to limit the scope of those rules and dictate its own safety standards so that it can build out CO2 pipeline infrastructure as quickly as possible, since it stands to benefit from huge tax incentives for CCS passed under the Biden administration. And what I found as I dug further into those lobbying records is that oil companies and their trade groups are now trying to pressure lawmakers to use this PHMSA reauthorization process to push through measures that could further criminalize pipeline protests at the federal level. And the federal penalty for damaging or destroying pipelines is already a felony charge of up to 20 years in prison. But in hearing testimony that I found and policy briefs posted online, oil industry trade group executives were basically pushing lawmakers to expand the definition of so-called attacks on pipelines that can be punished under felony charges to include vague language like disruptions of service or attacks on construction sites. And that could implicate a much broader set of activities that are used to protest fossil fuel infrastructure. So something like disruption of service or interfering at a construction site, that could implicate anything from planting corn in the path of a pipeline construction to a march or a sit-in at a site. And it's really hard to say what that actually means, which is why it's so concerning. And we're now already seeing this language show up in committee bills. So the House Energy and Commerce Committee's draft reauthorization bill, which was one of two committee bills being negotiated before the legislation goes to the Senate, would add impairing the operation of pipelines, damaging or destroying such a facility under construction, and even attempting or conspiring to do so as felony activities, punishable by up to 20 years in prison. Mm. So this is something industry lobby groups have tried before, back in 2019, to use this reauthorization process towards this purpose. They say it's about preventing damage or destruction of pipelines that could create a harmful situation for communities on the ground. But again,
right,
that's already a felony under federal law. This rulemaking process is supposed to be about protecting community members and making sure pipelines are safe, not about preventing protests.
Well, you've hit all the points, but let me just draw some out, because the perversity here, it's not irony. This is coming at the center of legislative work about rules for industry due to devastating harms like breaches in a carbon dioxide pipeline, things that have actively harmed the community. So in the process of legislating rules around that, fossil fuel makers have said, oh, well, while we're talking about safety of pipelines, let's also wiggle in this idea that protesters might be endangering pipelines. And then here's where it gets to peak irony. The idea that protesters might cause harm to human beings by protesting pipelines, when the context is we're talking about the harm that these pipelines themselves have caused. I mean, it's kind of off the chart.
Exactly. And this is as these same companies are continuing to invest in more and more fossil fuel infrastructure, while every scientific body is telling us that we have to do the opposite to avoid cataclysmic climate impacts. So they're really using this growing pushback against their own operations to take this opportunity to silence that opposition.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then, of course, the vagueness of the language, which you point to in the piece, that is part of it, that you're not supposed to quite understand, well, what counts as protest, what counts as impairing the operation of the pipeline. It's very much suppressive of free speech and action. Yeah,
exactly. There's precedent for this. This is, as you alluded to in your opening, this is part of a larger push to pass laws criminalizing protest of fossil fuel infrastructure since the protests against Keystone XL and Dakota Access, which brought together enormous coalitions of people that crossed cultural and political boundaries to oppose those pipelines. And much of the legislation we've seen since then, which has been lobbied for by companies like Exxon and Marathon, Koch and Enbridge, much of that legislation was primarily based on a model bill crafted by the oil and gas-funded American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, which made it a felony to trespass on the industry's so-called critical infrastructure. And those critical infrastructure bills use a lot of the same very vague types of language to describe trespass, which can make it incredibly dangerous, not just for protesters, many of whom are indigenous people and farmers and other landowners just trying to protect their land and water rights, but also journalists and the press who go to report on these protests on the ground. And again, it's just especially concerning when the cost to the planet and people's safety are so high.
I just want to ask, finally, it's kind of open-ended, but I mean, it's just not plausible to think that people are going to stop resisting or stop protesting or stop speaking out against the harms climate disruption is inflicting that are evident much more every single day. And I just wonder, obviously, these fossil fuel companies are hoping that news media will kind of use their age-old frames about criminality and law-breaking to sort of push people back into the idea of, oh, it's okay to want what you want, like not to see the capacity for human life on the planet destroyed. It's okay for you to want that, but just do it through proper channels. Don't do it by protesting, because now that's illegal in a new way. And I just wonder, media have to do something different. Big media have to do something different to actually rise to this occasion.
I think it's all about talking to the actual people on the ground who are doing the protesting. Like you said, it's so easy to paint people as criminals when the definition of a criminal is defined or written by the same industry trying to protect the product that those people are protesting. So I think it's just so important to get their perspective, find out why they're there. A lot of the time, these are regular people, not just activists who are there because of the climate, but also just people who are there trying to protect their water, protect their land and their homes and livelihoods, or journalists who are trying to report on what's going on. And I just think getting their voice heard from a source is the most important thing.
We've been speaking with Emily Sanders, senior reporter for Exxon News. You can find the piece, Big Oil Wants to Increase Federal Criminal Penalties for Pipeline Protests, online at exxonnews.org as well as levernews.com. Thank you so much, Emily Sanders, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks again for having me.
A lot of us have started seeing local weather forecasts with numbers unfamiliar to us for this time of year. As reporters, you could treat that as, oh, isn't that curious? How are folks on the street dealing with this? Are sales of sunscreen going up? Or, as a reporter, you can seriously engage the predicted disastrous effects of fossil fuel production as predicted and disastrous. Not, though, in terms of what in other contexts we would call criminal. So what does it look like when business as usual is called out as an actual crime? Our next guest is reporting on an important case in a county in Oregon. Veteran journalist and educator Victoria St. Martin covers health and environmental justice at Insight Climate News. She joins us now by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Victoria St. Martin.
Thank you so much. I'm so honored to be here.
So what happened in summer 2021 in Northwest Oregon such that it became the subject of scientific study? What happened there? What were the harms?
The county called this a heat dome disaster, but basically there was a heat dome over 3 days in June of 21 that recorded highs of 108, 112, 116 degrees Fahrenheit. During that time, 69 people died from heat stroke, and most of them were in their homes. Typically, in this part of Oregon, they have very gentle summers. The highs top out at about 81 degrees, but this was unprecedented. And one of the attorneys that is working with the county says this was not an act of God. This was not caused by God, but caused by climate change.
And that's exactly the point. Oftentimes, folks might be surprised to hear, but environmental impacts were legitimately, legally written off, if you will, as acts of God. This is just nature. This is just what's happening. So this is actually something new.
Yes, the attorney that I was speaking about, his name's Jeffrey B. Simon. He's a lawyer for the county. He talks about this idea of how, no, this is not an act of God. This catastrophe was caused by several of the world's largest energy companies playing God with the lives of innocent and vulnerable people by selling as much oil and gas as they could.
Well, what is a heat dome, just for folks who might not know?
Let's see. How would I describe it? I would call it the atmosphere creating an intense umbrella of heat, mm-hmm. and especially in areas where they don't typically see this type of heat.
Right, right.
Like Northwest Oregon, we've had heat domes this summer, right, already all across the nation in places that typically don't have this type of high heat.
So it's a thing we all need to get familiar with. If you don't know what it means today, you need to figure it out for tomorrow.
Yeah, some scientists, they say it's like the atmosphere traps hot air. And yeah, I said an umbrella, but like a lid or a cap being put on a bottle, right? And trapping that hot air for days like it did in Northwest Oregon.
Well, we've had issues with news media who kind of want to separate the stories. It's not that they don't cover things. It's that they don't connect dots. They separate a story from here was a heat emergency in this particular case, and it was horrible, and people were suffered from it. And then on another page or on another day, they'll have a story about fossil fuel companies, lobbyists influencing laws. But part of the problem with news media is they don't connect these things. And so I wonder, as a person who, besides being a journalist, a person who thinks about journalism, where are the gaps or the omissions or the missing dots that you think that media could be doing on this could not be more important story of climate disruption?
Yes. One of my editors says that covering climate, it's one of the greatest stories of the century, right? It's the greatest story of our lifetime that we are covering. And I think one thing that we did well, journalism-wise, in the past 10 or so years, is we've pushed this idea that journalists have to be multidimensional, right? That they have to know how to edit photo and video and create a graphic and write a story, right? But what I think was lost in that, and what is important here and what is missing in these heat dome stories, in these climate change stories, these stories that are very, very plainly, as you can see, our climate change stories, what is missing here is journalists aren't necessarily trained to be multidimensional in subject matter, right? And while there are environmental desks growing in newsrooms throughout the nation, newsrooms aren't allowing the journalists to kind of interdisciplinary roles, right? To be able to cover a weather event and talk about climate. And we need to do more of that. I think in order to connect those dots, to connect the dots of the health harms and the climate disasters that are happening, we need to do more of that. I love how last summer, I think I really saw it come to a head because the Canadian wildfires were coming, came to the East Coast and turned the skies orange in New York. And it was like this story you could not ignore anymore. And it forced newsrooms to really start talking about wildfires and is it safe to breathe the air? And what is the air pollution from a wildfire? And what causes wildfires? I think we need to do more of that. While I don't want climate disasters like wildfires continue to happen, I do want journalists to think on their toes, think on their feet, think multidimensional, and be able to tell stories in a full and nuanced way, because we are not servicing our readers, our viewers, our listeners if we aren't. Our viewers, our listeners, and our readers are here to get the full story, and we need to give them the full story and the full picture.
Well, and just finally, in terms of journalistic framework, what I think is so interesting is with the Multnomah County story is we're moving the actions of fossil fuel companies into the category of crime. You knew this was going to cause harm, and you still did it, and it caused harm, and that's a crime. And I feel like that's, for journalism, for media, that's a framework shift. Lobbying is a story, and legislative influence is a story. And then crime is a whole different story on a whole other page. But if we're talking about actions that cause people to die, that cause people to be harmed, well, then a lot of things that fossil fuels companies are doing are crimes. And that's what's paradigm breaking with this Multnomah County story.
I think also what's different here is the attorneys reaching out. Once the county filed suit, once the attorneys filed suit, letting us know what's happening, making sure that the story is amplified and gets out there. I think I appreciate it always as a journalist when there's like an open dialogue and that I'm able to share the story with readers, viewers, and listeners because I had access to information. I had access to the lawsuit, I think, what is that saying? When a tree falls in the forest?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so thankful that somebody called me up and said, hey, this is what's happening. So I think everybody does their part. And I think in this case, it was a moment of allowing journalists to be able to be a part of that process and to be able to see behind the curtain and see what's actually happening. Sometimes law can be
slow
and boring and monotonous. Mm-hmm. And I think just like anything, right, like science. But I think when you allow journalists to have a front row seat, it helps to tell the story.
Absolutely. Well, any final thoughts in terms of what you would like folks to take away from this piece that you wrote about the effort to call fossil fuel companies out for the harms that they're causing? Any tips for other journalists who might be looking at the same story?
I think one thing I constantly thought about when I was reporting this story, and something I did not see, is there's a great database looking at lawsuits that have been filed by states and counties and cities that are seeking damages from oil and gas companies for the harms caused by climate change. There are about 3 dozen lawsuits right out there right now. But this is one of the only ones that is focused on a heat dome disaster, focused on a heat dome. This is one of the only lawsuits that is focused on a heat dome. And so this is what makes that case unique. This is what makes it rise to the level of, this is what kind of sets this case apart from the rest.
Right.
And for me, that was important to report. So I'm thankful that you got to read it and that others have gotten to read it. And I hope more people read about it, because I think that was key here. And that was something I did not see before. Like, there are other lawsuits, but this one, a lot of law experts think could really change the game here, because it's focusing on a specific disaster and how it's focusing on a specific disaster and how this county is going to pay for the costs that they've incurred from the effects of the heat dome. I think for journalists, when we're reporting on these things, think of ways to get ahead of the pack. Think of ways to kind of, what makes the story unique? What sets the story apart from other weather event stories or other climate change stories, and how to really help paint a picture about how important this story is. 69 people died over the course of 3 days. I mean, that is huge. And it is something that, for me, that was something that needed to be at the top of the story.
Absolutely.
You know, the fact that 69 people died was something that needed to be at the top of the story for me. The fact that this was one of the only cases that looks at heat dome disasters, that was something that needed to be at the top of the story for me. And I hope to keep reporting on this. So I can't wait to see what happens next.
All right, then. Well, we've been speaking with journalist Victoria St. Martin. You can find her work on this and other stories at insideclimatenews.org. Victoria St. Martin, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is produced each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Mom and Dad used to argue about everything, especially about Dad's drinking. My family went from totally crazy to quiet, calm, and even peaceful when Mom started going to Al-Anon family groups. I wanted a better relationship with Dad, so I asked Mom if she would take me to her Al-Anon meetings or to Alateen. I'm sure glad I did. If someone's drinking troubling you, you might be surprised at what you can learn in an Al-Anon or Alateen family group from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-ALANON or go to alanon.org.
From KUT and KUTX Studios.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
Again, I knew I wanted to be in commercial real estate, but I didn't know anybody. So my sister happened to be dating a politician who was an important guy in town, Michael Hightower. So I called Michael. It made sense to me. Let me call the most influential person I knew to see if he knew anybody. And he did. He introduced me to a guy named Bill Comer. And I asked Bill, is it possible for me to come and shadow you because I'm thinking about getting into commercial real estate? He said, I'll work it out. It may not be with me, but it'll be somebody in my shop. It ended up being a guy named Steve Gaultney. Steve was kind enough to allow me to shadow him and took me around, showed me some listings and some properties that he sold before and clients that he was working with. He said, I'm going to take you to a meeting. Don't say anything, but you can sit in on a meeting and listen.
T. Dallas Smith, founder and CEO of T. Dallas Smith & Company, the largest African-American-owned pure tenant representation commercial real estate firm in the country. For more than a decade and a half, TDS & Company has taken pride in catering to the needs of clients requiring office space, industrial facilities, and land. Headquartered in Atlanta, Georgia, with affiliate offices in Boston, Dallas, Los Angeles, San Francisco, San Diego, and Short Hills, New Jersey, their projects span the nation. In 1989, Smith became the first African-American broker at Cushman & Wakefield of Georgia. 6 years later, he would go on to pioneer the brokerage division of Atlanta's landmark African-American-owned real estate and construction firm, H.J. Russell & Company. Throughout his career, Smith had dedicated himself to exposing African-Americans to the commercial real estate industry. In case you weren't aware, less than 4% of commercial real estate executives are African-American. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, T. Dallas Smith & Company with founder and CEO T. Dallas Smith, In Black America.
December 2006, I was partners with another guy, had another company I was partners with, but that company was kind of going under. But during that process, I met a young man who happened to be 19, came to me and wanted to get into real estate. And a lot of people would do that. Nobody years, I would say, do you have your license? And people typically say, no, I don't. I say, get your license. We'll talk. And I've done it over years for at least 50 people, and nobody ever came back. But this kid, Leontay Benton, came back in 3 weeks with his license, which is unheard of. And at this point, I'm going, okay, the company I'm a part of is kind of about to go under. I get the epiphany that this kid is a lot like me, and that what I really need to do is start a brokerage company, and I can help this guy and help other people who look like me get into the space.
Under T. Dallas Smith's leadership, his commercial real estate firm, T. Dallas Smith & Company, will go on to work with some of the largest companies in the nation, from Microsoft and Coca-Cola to AT&T and FedEx. Born and raised in Atlanta, Georgia, Smith grew up in an all-black...
whet up your axe, whistle up your dog, whet up your axe and whistle up your dog. We're off to the woods to hunt groundhog, groundhog. Old Joe Digger, Sam and Dave, old Joe Digger, Sam and Dave, went a hog hunting hard as they could stave, groundhog. Too many rocks, too many logs. Too many rocks and too many logs. Too many rocks to hunt groundhog, groundhog. He's in here, boys, the holes war slick. He's in here, boys, the holes war slick. Run here, Sam, with your forked stick, groundhog. Stand back, boys, let's be wise. Stand back, boys, and let's be wise. I think I see his beaded eyes, groundhog. Yonder comes Sam with a 10-foot pole. Yonder comes Sam with a 10-foot pole to rouse that groundhog out of his hole, groundhog. Grab him by the tail and pull him out. Grab him by the tail and pull him out. Great God Almighty, ain't a groundhog stout, groundhog. Here he comes all in a whirl. Here he comes all in a whirl. He's the biggest groundhog in this world, groundhog. Work, boys, work hard as you can tear. Work, boys, work hard as you can tear. The meat'll do to eat and the hide'll do to wear, groundhog. Skin him out and tan his hide. Skin him out and tan his hide. Best darn shoestrings of a high tried, groundhog. Children scream, the children cried. Children scream, the children cried. They love that groundhog cooked and fried, groundhog. I love my groundhog stewed and fried. Love my groundhog stewed and fried. A little plate of soup is sitting by the side, groundhog. Up steps Sal with a snigger and a grin. Up steps Sal with a snigger and a grin. Groundhog grease all over her chin, groundhog. Hello, Mama, make Sam quit. Hello, Mama, make Sam quit. He's eating all the hog and don't leave me a bit, groundhog. Hello, boys, ain't it a sin? Hello, boys, ain't it a sin? Rots that gravy, run down Sam's chin, groundhog. Watch him, boys, he's about to fall. Watch him, boys, he's about to foul. He's at till his pants won't button at all.